how for Senator Victor Fisher and Chair. I believe Senator Paul Fisher is absolutely excused from the excusable cause. Excuse me. I believe Senator Mawson is here. But he is the present counsel, which has been in conflict with the schedule. You have in your folder section 467 and a sectional analysis. And I will state what the staff sectional analysis says so that if witnesses want to explain or correct any misapprehensions you feel we may be laboring under, you may do so. Section 1 removes employees of the University of Alaska from Class 2 of the Alaska Labor Relations Act. Class 2 allows for mediation and the right of limited strike. According to this analysis, university employees would then be in Class 3, allowing unlimited strike. Section 2 removes temporary part-time employees of the university from the definition of public employees, which I take it has to do with the issue from the Anchorage Community College bargaining round, which, as I understand it, concerns the rights or collective bargaining rights of adjunct faculty members. Section 3 provides that this act will not affect any collective bargaining agreement in effect on the effective date of this act. And Section 4 is the effective date. Also in the folder is a statement from University President Jay Barton, telegram from the University, from the Teacher Union's Chief Negotiator Don Moore, telegram from the Western Alaska Building Trade Council opposing the bill, letters from Dave Dow, Kip Bursella, and Roy Reisinger, faculty members of Anchorage Community College, and copies of statutes relating to the bill. In addition, we have available to us materials from various proceedings of the Labor Relations Agency for the state in causes 83-1, 83-3, 83-2, 83-5, 83-6, 83-7, 83-9, 83-10, which appear all related to the controversy involving employees of the Anchorage Community College. And I'll recognize witnesses in order of their indicated appearance. Dr. Barton.
Chairman, my name is Jay Barton. I'm the president of the University of Alaska. May I make two other requests? One, that the statement I submitted be made part of the record. And I would read it if you shared the copy, if you want to read it in the record. If not, you can just make it
part. We will make it part of the record. And we may have a transcript of these proceedings made. And if so, I will ask that Dr. Barton's memorandum proposed changes in the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, dated February 24, be inserted.
My second comment is that it's my understanding that the second part of the proposed change emphasizes the temporary part-time. Our intent is certainly not to keep part-time faculty from rights of collective action of collective bargaining. This is the emphasis on temporary. I think that's the key point.
What is meant by temporary? Is a teacher hired to teach a semester's course a temporary employee?
I think it depends on the terms of the contract more than anything else. It has to do as much with the benefits, education rights, and things like that. Statements that are part of, or conditions that are part of the public employee law. I have a brief statement for you today, sir, since the essence of my statement was I bring you some 33 years of experience in universities as a faculty member or administrator. About half of that, 15 years, was in private institutions, and about half in public institutions. I had a good deal of experience in problem solving, conflict resolution, and shared governance in a variety of institutions. What do we do about solving problems or reaching collective agreement in higher education? First, I think we recognize that in a professional environment in general, and in a university academic environment in particular, the faculty of the institution have authentic authority. They have true professional knowledge that no one else has, and that university entities that have truly achieved eminence tap that professional judgment and professional authority and use it to develop the entire institution. The phenomenon is called shared governance, and it's in operation in almost every institution in America. It involves sharing responsibility and sharing authority in ways that really uses the authentic authority that the faculty member has. This isn't always sufficient, and in many cases, we develop in higher education collective bargaining procedures and practices. In many cases, they work beautifully. I think that they can. There's nothing in principle that says that they can't work. A lot depends on how they work in practice. Many of the institutions that are involved in collective bargaining in sharing governance in higher education are two-year institutions, and that, of course, is where the University of Alaska is, with more than 200 faculty members in our community college system involved in collective bargaining with the university. I think it can work well. I don't think it's working well in Alaska, and that's the reason that I'm representing the university today and asking that you consider carefully the classification in which you place university faculty. The problem that I see is this, is that if the faculty and the administration, in a private institution or in a public institution, engage in collective bargaining over whatever factors they determine are fit subject or tightly restricted, whatever they choose, they ought to reach an agreement. And I think we would all agree that, we would all agree that it's far preferable university environment, or perhaps in any environment, that we reach an agreement rather than have a forced decision. Binding arbitration is very much like the problem of going to court and asking somebody else to solve a problem for you. Make sure that you advise your clients to stay out of court as much as possible, not just for cost, but because it may be an inappropriate way to resolve that particular problem. And that's point one. I think that in general, compulsory binding arbitration in a university setting is an inappropriate way to resolve differences among employees and administrators. It's inappropriate because it asks a third person who may or may not have any understanding of the interests and objectives of the faculty and may or may not have any understanding of the interests, knowledge, and character of the institution to solve some very complex issues. It's very much, as I said a moment ago, like asking a judge to solve your problems for you when the chances are that you and your opponent disagreeer could reach an agreement, you'd be much happier with that resolution than the one that was imposed by a judge. Secondly,
Jay, I agree with that. I started practicing law in the early 60s and was interested in the approach taken by some anchor judges doing something I'd never seen in law school, where they could say, Judge Davis was saying this, that let you people go out in the next room and solve this because any decision you make is probably going to be wiser than what I make. And very often that had the effect of getting the parties to resolve their differences. But I still think it was desirable that the judge be there in case that process didn't work. So what I'm saying is there's no quarrel that it's better if the parties can reach their own settlement rather than go to mediation or arbitration in court. But oftentimes, there has to be that independent judgment if there's an impasse.
I think you bring up a critical point here that mediation can be remarkably effective. Mediation provides a different perspective without necessarily control. I distinguish sharply between mediation and arbitration. And in that case you mentioned, it would appear to me that the judge, although having the steel in his glove, perhaps, was proposing a mediated approach rather than arbitrated approach. And I don't think that's bad. I think in many cases, universities, in all sorts of agreements and problem resolution universities, we tend to use mediation as a method of choice. The second reason, though, that I think compulsory binding arbitration doesn't fit in the university is one that has been raised by a number of legal scholars, and I am not prepared to make legal issues, but it may be an improper delegation authority or a proper usurpation of authority as a person who is not accountable to the legislature, to the public, to the institution, or to any constitutionally established authority. think arbitration is so much a part of our national scene, however, that the constitutional argument unlikely to prevail. I'll bring it up in the record. The third point is the most important one. I think the history of collective bargaining at the University of Alaska reflects this to some extent, although I don't know what happened prior to 1979, when we did have some arbitrated settlements. At best, the fact that compulsory arbitration was there has a chilling effect on negotiation. You mentioned a moment ago that the fact that it's back there might force people to come to a settlement. That's the hope. That indeed is the hope. But it's one that I don't quite see in our own negotiations. It means, and people that have been at the table for some years tell me that, assure me of this, it means that most of the time they, that is the university table team and the union table team, spend a great deal of effort to be sure that a case is made and a record is made for the arbitrator to look at, rather than spending a great deal of time to be sure that you and I agree on the issues and reach some common resolution. That's a perversion of collective bargaining, one that I don't think we need. I think that you can look at the United States as a whole and see that private universities that have union contracts and engage in collective bargaining under the National Labor Relations Act do not have binding arbitration, and yet they have as good, or at least as good, a record of labor relations as public institutions. Secondly, the Alaska teachers do not have binding arbitration as part of the laws under which they engage in collective bargaining in the public sector here in Alaska, even though there is constant agitation to add it, and they seem to survive fairly well. Why should you insist that university faculty and employees be subject to compulsory binding arbitration when it doesn't fit your own Alaskan precedents, nor does it fit the public and private precedents in the rest of the nation? That's basically my conclusion. Senator, I'd be pleased to answer questions.
Very well, thank you, Dr. Barton. Senator, one of the things that disturbed me about this proposition is that apparently there have been, as I count them, nine separate cases in the Labor Relations Agency, and as I understand it, the university lost on eight of those occasions and won some minor issues in the ninth case.
I try not to use the word.
We have all our material here, and I am loath to intrude the legislature into the midst of a crisis on one side or the other, particularly if the appearance is on one side that seems that we have represented the Labor Relations Agency here to have committed unfair labor practices by the judgment of the agency. Usually the university is in a position of asking us to stay out of these kinds of matters and recognize academic freedom and self-governance and university autonomy and political control. And here the university seems to be saying to the legislators, come to our rescue because we're not winning these proceedings and we've been found to be guilty of unfair labor practices.
Mr. Senator, let me comment. First of all, we're not asking that you erase collective bargaining or erase the Public Employees Labor Relations Act. But not at all. And in no sense would the presence or absence of binding arbitration reflect that kind of a record. That is not of the essence. We're not asking that you interfere. The fact that you raised the question, though, I find interesting because it would appear from the way in which you asked the question and the kinds of comments that I've gotten throughout the state that compulsory binding arbitration is seen as highly favorable to labor.
No, I'm just saying there's a change in the rules of the game while the game is after the whistle started.
We've got time for that. Effective days or something else. And that non-binding compulsory arbitration be something, that binding compulsory arbitration would be favorable to unions, whereas freedom to strike, to use that true economic weapon, freedom on the part of the university to face the economic consequences of that, is apparently seen as favorable to the university.
What's better for the students, freedom to strike or binding arbitration?
I think if you can look to the private sector for that, see that if indeed withholding of work is the ultimate weapon of faculty as well as any other labor member, that indeed is an option that they have to have. At the moment, it's sort of interesting. At the moment, there's a kind of a ritual that takes place in which I guess because on two past occasions, the strike vote has been taken after impasse was declared, and then a strike was held, and then an injunction was granted, and then an arbitrator was appointed. And unless all of those conditions are met, you can't appoint an arbitrator. You have to go through this little ritual. I'm sure that Ralph can help me on the number of days that the strike lasted, but they were relatively short strikes of little economic consequence, little economic cost to anybody. They got us to the point where we turned the whole problem over to a third party and said, you solve it, we can. I'd like to solve the problem.
Do other senators have questions, Dr. Martin? Mr. Senator?
I would like to have a little background. How did the university get into collective bargaining in the first place? I mean, the university wasn't specifically written into legislation, such as other educational institutions. Now you want to say, but not including the University of Alaska. At some point, the university must have agreed of its own volition to participate in this.
I'll give you my distant perception of history, and perhaps there are others in the room that can be a little more accurate. At one time, the chairman of the board was Mr. McFarland. At a time when labor in the state, labor unions in the state were in the ascendancy, I would say, politically and the euphoric phase of the pipeline construction, probably quite rightly, they helped the region. However, the story, the report I have is that Mr. McFarland was interested, because of the Labor Relations Act, to have the union also, the university also develop collective bargaining. It's the only unit that, by analysis, either by the board or administration or somebody, would have supported that, was the community college faculty. All of the faculty does not have the student. The key in the law is this, is that it is the right of an employee. It isn't the responsibility of an employer to create a union, it's the right of an employee to organize collectively and have a union. That right, I think the law protects, you might get some. My understanding is that back in the early 70s, there was not sufficient interest among university employees, except in this one group. And my reading of history is that some very stupid management decisions at least one of our institutions led to the union. Led to the frustration that ultimately resulted in the faculty organizing and saying this is the only way to solve our problem. That's my reading of history.
Dr. Martin, this is such an interesting subject. And I think we will spend the bulk of the afternoon on it and come to a decision. But one thing that I will tell you from just a political point of view is that I have great apprehension favoring this if the result is a cessation of work, because I have, to be very blunt with you, I faced the voters in the fall of 1984, and I have nothing except your prognostication that a strike will be a short strike, and I have the problem of what happens if I have students who are expecting to get their Associate of Arts degrees in June, whose careers will be interrupted, and who will say, Senator Josephson participated in this and chose strike over arbitration. Those students could care less about the merits of the controversy and the interesting question of autonomy and control and governance. They are interested in their program. And what, you know, if you're wrong, and regrettably you'll be leaving, but if you're wrong, I'll be in Alaska living with that and you'll be gone. I'm very disturbed about that.
Let me be sure you understand. I am not predicting a short or a long strike. No mining compulsory arbitration. What I would predict is that with compulsory arbitration as the ultimate problem resolution method, that strike will be short. And they have been short in the past. I think that's my prediction. Were it not to be there, I think a strike would be much longer.
Can you give me your forwarding address if you're
right? No, I think it's important to make that distinction.
All right. Let's send it out.
Say that one more time.
Under our present law, which says that if we can't agree with the union, and the union can't agree with us. Ultimately, we reach impasse, the agency declares impasse, we try mediation, declare impasse again. At that point, they take a strike vote. They may or may not exercise that strike vote. Unless they exercise it, or unless there's a voluntary agreement to go to an arbitrator, they have to strike somebody has to join the strike, either the agency or some other concerned party, as being contrary to the public interest. Once that injunction is granted, then an arbitrator is appointed. That's the way the law is. The reason is this, is that I think in order to get to arbitration, in order to solve problems today,
it's a pro forma, correct?
That's essentially, I call it a ritual thing. And the necessity will be short.
But if this bill passes, if you say it's a ritual, if you say that, but you say it's a ritual, but pass the bill and give the teachers the effective remedy on strike, which is the American way in the collective bargaining district, that would not necessarily be a ritual, because the American way is sometimes a long work stop.
Precisely. If we didn't have that, the present ritual, and had an unlimited right to strike, unlimited responsibility for any consequences, I would hope that the collective bargaining would be much more realistic, and that we could come to an agreement, because the consequences for both parties would be damn serious.
Mr. Malone, it seems to me that the lines have been pretty well drawn, and the likelihood would be that the university would not want to recede from where it stands today. And if a strike were called on April 1st, as Senator Josephson points out, these students may pass graduation day without the strike being over, because there's no incentive for the university to come to the bargaining table. You've set down your terms. According to all the documents we have, the university has not wanted much from its position. The union has its position very clearly set. And we go into the fall semester and we're still on strike. My concern was the chairman's is with the student. I mean, when we had a strike in Anchorage in the public schools, I was appalled by the fact that the kids were not getting educated. I am for arbitration in the case of public school teachers, because I don't want the kids to be subjected to strikes.
I understand. I do understand your position, sir.
And I see the same problem here. What about the students?
I think you can ask that not just of me, but of the union as well.
I'll ask that when they get there.
And I think the point is that I'd like to see this become a true method of collecting bargaining, not an adversarial approach, but as far as some third party resolution that just divides the issues, perhaps. I want to see us really solve the problems. I proposed this year, with I think less success than I hope, new approaches to collecting bargaining. I have to try to have these solutions and other solutions. From an adversarial position, they create a much more collegial
environment. Oh, it's
created by the we've tried a number of ways of getting agreement. But this year is a very difficult situation. We are asking the union for things that haven't been asked for before. And it is. But the consequences for the university of a strike are just as serious as the consequences for the faculty and the media members. And that I'd like to redress that balance.
I would prefer to see, whatever method is used, accomplished without a strike, which is at the expense of students. It's not at the expense of the university as an institution. It's not at the expense of the union as an institution. It's the students who suffer, so far as I'm concerned. If I had a choice, I'd put you in class one and not even have a ritual dance.
Another question,
just for some kind of baseline, how does the pay scale in our university system compare to the other state university system? If we're talking about the pay and benefits and conditions, where are we on these scales?
If I take the university faculty as a whole and compare them at various ranks and make comparisons across the nation, the university falls generally on this market curve. If you make what sometimes we call the Alaska Pinnacle. The Bureau of Labor Statistics adjustment that the state government uses in adjusting salaries for Alaska cost of labor. It's about $4,000 plus 10%. That's basically what the labor market is. If you make that adjustment, our assistant professors are a little bit above the market. They're paid a little better than they are in the 48 instructors too.
Are they spread the whole market?
It's about $30,000, our average faculty. $35,000 is our average faculty salary. That's this right here. There are some that tail out to the high side, and this is probably a little more chunky than the low side. That average, again, the last one, current labor statistics adjustment, is reasonably close to the national average. Now, the community college faculty at the moment, because of the history of 14 months of negotiation, is a little behind that average. If you separate the community college faculty from the rest of the university faculty, they're a little behind, and I don't know the absolute value of that increase, but it's real.
They're below the national average.
They have been, up until this last year, they have been ahead of the faculty, right? My position has been that community colleges are an integral part of the university. They meet one of the missions of my grad institution. And we do well. These are university faculty that ought to be in the basic faculty average faculty compensation. If, however, we split them out, we compare community college faculty in Alaska with community college faculty in the rest of the Lower 48, we find that our faculty are extremely wealthy. They are well above the average of community college faculty, even with the annual adjustment.
Well, what it appears that you're saying then is history has adjusted our system and the university as a whole in about the same way that it's adjusted other universities. However, if our system is just applied to community colleges, then our system is better than average, but it's just kind of
example of a job that is absolutely necessary to be done ask them to commit their professional life to that, then they ought to share in the reward system. So that I would like to reward those people just as much as I would like to reward some engineering program that's in great demand at the moment, as the more possessed. So that I think, yes, I think the community college faculty are an important component of the total university's mission, and I'm comfortable rewarding them as university faculty.
So the whole circle brings us around to the salary and pay scales of the university system, both in the four-year program and in the community colleges, represents what you think is an accurate reflection of the contribution and the comparison to other institutions. The question has to come back to me then, if the system that is in place is working and has produced that result, why do you want to change it?
I guess I don't understand the question. The issues that before us are really not economic, I think. Community knows as well as all of us in this room know the limits on economic resources in the state. It's not a matter of education or more pay. In fact, pay we hardly discuss.
Well, that's because at one point the university,
that's
because at one point the university, I'm told, would not negotiate until the union agreed a priori to several demands involving the replacement with the merit system of the current advancement pay system, the increased workload. I understand that's a semantic question as to whether that is a factor of increase, I'm not judging that, and the elimination of the so-called union subsidy by the university.
No, sir. I don't think at any time, I'm not sure this is the place to debate on the table, but we are more than willing to negotiate. I think that I face too many people in the state who view adherence to a position and to a principle as meaning refusing to negotiate. I'm perfectly willing to negotiate. So it's the table team. Oh, God, just because you can't reach agreement doesn't mean that you...
Well, I appreciate that. I try to negotiate with Senator Halford. But I'm...
Sometimes you change it.
But there were unfair labor charges going to the refusal of the university to negotiate without at least some precondition, which I understand were upheld by the labor relations agency. I don't want to debate that with you, Doctor. I just want you to know what information we have in case you want to correct it.
I'm not sure it would be appropriate. I'm not sure this is the place to rehash or re-debate those issues. We thought our position was right at the time the labor agency said it was. But I can assure you that nobody entered into these for gameplay. We entered into them for unfair.
Staff, specifically this type of thing, just to use as a hands-on.
can't speak for what conversations happen in the university. This is my own personal experience with the university.
Sort of a more general question. Do you have suggestions as to a more effective approach to resolve disputes such as the one between ACC, AFD, and the university, or any others that come before you?
We've not tried it. We've looked at a lot of different methods because, quite basically, we follow off the prosecutor before we get to the arbitration. There has to be some other way to do it to satisfy both parties. And we've kind of looked at this mediation arbitration as having a little bit more than just regular arbitration. We had an arbitrator, a mediator up here with Gene Rose, who was with the Federal Mediation Service Association of Anchorage, that was kind of like that project that we talked about a lot from the beginning of mediation. And it makes a lot of sense, right? It's the judge. I'll issue my decision if you people can't reach your agreement. But, you know, it's really a lot better if you can come to it yourselves. And that's what a MEDARB does for you. It puts the pressure on the parties to come to an agreement, and then the last resort, if they can't, he makes the decision themselves. And there's variances of that process.
Well, the argument was made by Dr. Martin that this removes from the public authority its constitutional responsibilities or unlawful delegation.
Dr. Martin addressed two different kinds of subjects. To address economic issues, which we've got an obligation to place back before you after reaching agreement, and non-monetary issues, the work time, class level, things like that. You have an absolute right in the first place to make any, to decline to appropriate money without a contract. That's still your last right.
So that the arbitrator's decision is still subject to the legislature's overview?
On the monetary terms.
On the monetary terms.
You just passed a bill defining monetary terms, which might take out the workload of parties. We'll talk about productive hours being monetary terms.
Might take out the workload.
Yeah. In SB 55, which passed requiring a joint resolution on negotiable agreements, you put in a definition of what monetary terms were. Not only things requiring money, but adjustments to the work hours. So
if, in theory, in this instance, and I know this is outside the realm, but if the arbitrator found that the workload, instead of being increased from 12 to 15 credits, should be reduced to 5 credits or 7 credits, we as a legislator could disprove that particular element.
Probably the university would triple the budget or something if they hadn't kept their staff. You know, they couldn't. If they currently teach 15 hours or 12 hours, and they just cut it, they're going to have to come back and say, to give the same level of services, we've got to double our staff. So you're going to have that for you.
All right. As experts, let me ask this. Assuming that hypothetically, and I think this is the position Senator Fisher and I espouse, the overriding concern here is continuity of program for the student. Do you have an opinion as to whether Senate Bill 467 or existing law is more likely to assure that continuity?
Obviously, the existing statute is favored continuity.
Senator Fisher? One of the points often brought up is that an arbitrator who is from outside Alaska doesn't understand, doesn't care, just comes in, hears the parties, makes a decision, goes away again. Sort of is unsatisfactory in terms of how wanted, our perception that we wanted somebody who lives here, who understands the impact of the settlement on taxes and the community and so on. Is there any alternative in terms of having local arbitrators, be they retired judges or whatever they might be? Can we do this locally?
We could agree to have this. We've had disputes with some of the unions that we deal with, and the agencies. We've agreed with the union, but we can't agree on an arbitrator, but we will agree on somebody from us. And the agencies can go to the point of denying
What more are you talking about, Susan?
I'm sorry, the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service maintains panels of arbitrators throughout the country. And those are the ones that use rights arbitration. So we'll ask the Federal Mediation Service for a list of arbitrators from the Pacific Northwest. If we ask them for Alaska only, I think we'd only get three names. But if you ask the American Arbitration Association for a list of Alaskan arbitrators, you'd get many more. The three. There's
and when do you ask which?
There's no rule. It's kind of what your personal preference is.
Now, would it be reasonable or unreasonable for the state for the legislature to stipulate that only Alaska arbitrators be used in arbitration within the state?
That could help you at times and hurt you at times. It's the kind of the thing that an advocate wants to choose on a case-by-case basis. It's not the kind of the thing that you just want to know.
But that's part of my question, whether we can take this out of the hands of the advocates, the two parties coming together, and just lay down the rule that you only use Alaskans who know Alaskan conditions and so on. I'm really asking a question. I'm not advocating this particular
If you line. Made that the law, it would work. There'd be people that would be arbitrators that you'd be allowed, that you'd be, you could select from. I mean, there's sufficient people, a body of people that you could draw from.
I think I'm a member of the AAA.
I wouldn't want to.
But neither would Dr. Barton. But I'm disappointed, Senator Fisher. That would be fair. But I think there probably are hundreds of arbitrators.
Just one last question in this line. Would that be a sensible thing to do from your perspective to limit arbitration to Alaskans?
I don't feel comfortable giving you a yes or no. There's several considerations. By drawing from outside, you're drawing from people that are more involved in labor arbitrations, and specifically interest arbitrations. They're more aware of what the settlements are in the geographic area that they're from. With the local conditions and what other people have agreed on. So they're more apt to be able to say, if the parties were able to strike and this was a normal negotiation, so this is what they'd end up with is in terms of their agreement. I don't know that if you says, we have to have an Alaskan arbitrator, if there would be sufficient people that would be familiar with those many facts.
Well, they might be able to offer creative solutions that the Alaskan parties don't even think about, but it would be novel in ways that is how
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You're welcome, Senator, despite your slur. Are there other questions of these gentlemen? No, I appreciate your coming. Unless you had other statement to make.
Or you're aware that we're not with the agents. We're with the division.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Cashin?
AFL-CIO. It would be wonderful if we didn't have any unions, we wouldn't have these kind of problems.
You wouldn't have a job.
Right. Teachers have a small 150-person unit that's affiliated with the State Federation of Labor. So we're here to support their position, which is in opposition to the bill. I guess we feel that somebody's trying to beat up on our little brothers and sisters. Obligation to come to their aid. Labor in the state's always been a strong supporter of the university. Many of us have attended the university and have sons and daughters attending there, so we've got strong ties there. This really upsets us to see what's happening with regard to the philosophy of the university in regards to labor relations. But we don't know what the problems are with the current negotiations, all kinds of reports and name calling on each side and everything, but we don't think this has a place in the administration or progressive North Alaska. And this legislation looks like it would, you know, just taken on one side. So We don't think the committee or the legislature should become involved in helping one side or the other, or even give the appearance. So we hope you vote the bill down and admonish all sides to get back to the bargaining table and settle the thing under the present para law, and, you know, to save everybody a lot of embarrassment. The second part of the bill, the temporary part-time thing, we also think that could be addressed in negotiations. So that would be our hope that you not pass this bill out. Thank you, Senator.
Are there questions of Mr. Cash? Thank you, sir. Mr. McGrath. My name is Ralph McGrath, and I'm the president of the Alaska Community College Federation of Teachers, which is a bargaining agent for approximately 300 community college teachers at some 12 different community colleges in the state. I've been a teacher in the University of Alaska since 1968. Gone through most of the university presidents.
Excuse me, Mr. McGrath. Senator Fakes, if you'd be more comfortable with us at the table.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it.
Excuse me. The statements of Dr. Barton, I think, are quite distorted and not an accurate representation of historical events or of the current situations in our negotiations. And the purpose of the documents that I've provided with you is simply to provide backup material to the two-page cover sheet that I think outlines pretty clearly the concerns of the ACCFT. First off, I think it's important, as was identified by some of the senators, the timing of this particular resolution. It was introduced at the request of the university. And it came, frankly, out of a Board of Regents meeting, December 2nd and 3rd in Anchorage, in which the regents were in an executive session. And after completing the executive session, of which the university legal counsel, Mr. Tom Owens, sat in for a couple of hours, after they came out of the executive session, it was only then that they raised the topic of amendments to the Public Employment Relations Act. Mr. Owens gave roughly a 10-minute presentation. There were two questions from the regents. One simply saying, this is the first time I understood the statute. The second one by a regent who wanted to know what the correct procedure was to pass the resolution. The regents voted. There was no other discussion on it. The vote was, I believe, 10 to nothing. And I think that behavior suggests quite a bit. Because if you would follow the events of the negotiations that had been ongoing with the university, it was about 3 weeks before that the State Labor Relations Agency again found that the university had committed numerous unfair labor practices in their collective bargaining with the teachers union. They were found to have engaged in surface bargaining, bad faith bargaining, bargaining with no intention of reaching an agreement, illusory bargaining, refusal to meet at reasonable times, refusal to meet at reasonable places. The attitude about full-time faculty was, I think, obvious from this. We have enjoyed and perhaps survived because since 1972, we have had the protections of the Public Employment Relations Act. We're comfortable with that. We think it does provide an orderly process, and it does provide resolution and finality to the negotiations if all else fails. The assault on part-time teachers, I think, is also ironic in that there is currently pending before the Superior Court a lawsuit involving the university, teachers' union, and the State Labor Relations Board over the rights of part-timers to self-organize. And it was only about 3 or 4 days, I believe, before the Regents had this meeting in December, that the State Labor Relations Agency finally determined criteria for eligibility for part-time faculty. And they identified very clearly what their regulations would be. Parties have engaged on the determination of part-time eligibility in public hearings in Juneau and Anchorage, I believe 4 different public hearings on what constitutes part-time eligibility. I believe the agency has all of the criteria to be able to make the determination of what is temporary part-time and what is permanent part-time, and are credited part-time teachers eligible or non-credited. That's what we have a labor relations board for. And
if they make that determination, what is your understanding would happen if the law does not change? Do those temporary and part-time people become public employees in the meeting of peril, or are they excluded?
The agency's criteria, which are currently before the Attorney General of Government, the Lieutenant Governor's Office for signature, as I understand them, are essentially these, that eligibility for collective bargaining purposes would be limited to those teachers who are teaching credited courses in an institution of higher education in the current semester, and who have also taught in a previous academic year. In other words, there must be continuity for eligibility.
In a previous year or the previous?
In the previous year. And those, I believe, are the criteria that the parties briefed and argued this before the agency. Testimony was presented, and the resolution is coming down from the agency. So why the university at this time suggests, well, again, if we can't prevail before the Labor Relations Board, let's take away the rights of the part-timers, I think is highly questionable.
If we can do this at the Regents' request, next year we could do it at your request. We could come in.
I hope so. We have a 31-member executive board, though, and not a 10-member board, and so I think our board can carry more weight.
But I mean, if it's, and this was the question I asked Dr. Barton, because I think this is a neutral question in terms of the merits of the dispute, but if one side can come to us while they are bargaining going on and saying, please amend the statute, then I suppose the next time that you can rally the votes, you can come in and ask us to change the statute in your way. And that's the part that disturbs me, that you're setting precedent for that.
I think that's correct. I do believe it opens up that type of avenue for change. I think the main thrust of my remarks are to focus that very few people, 10 regents, an outgoing president, and a Haida Christ attorney, are behind this endeavor. At no time did these people seek out the clerical workers, the classified workers, the maintenance workers, the university assembly, the ACC as the exclusive agent for the community college teachers, and suggestion. This came, as I mentioned, I think quite conveniently for the on December 2nd and 3rd. I have some, I'm puzzled by criteria that are academic criteria, openness and so on. I don't think that has been the case. The issue of taking away binding arbitration and also taking away the current right of limited strike, I think
history would tell us a few things about the relationship. And I challenged Dr. Barton's statements. The first time and the only time and the last time that the parties went to binding arbitration after a strike was in 1974. That, frankly, is 10 years ago. In 1976, there was a strike. The parties decided it was better not to leave that up to the arbitration process, and an agreement was negotiated out. Those are the only occasions that strikes have occurred, 74 and 76, binding arbitration only in 1974. So here we are in the middle of negotiations, highly questionable good faith bargaining by the university, and I can see why they would not want an arbitrator to settle their dispute. You bargain in bad faith for 14 months, what case can you take before an arbitrator? And we would have no difficulty with an in-state or an out-of-state arbitrator if that must be. Second thing I would point out, in 1974, the request for arbitration came from the university, not from the union. I'd be happy to share with you the documents. Dr. Defoe and the university press releases in 1974. University suggests arbitration. University wants arbitration. So we have a different flavor. What happened in 74 is that the arbitrator, and maybe I should explain the system as it evolved, at least in our circumstances, the system is that the superior court judge in this particular case said to the parties, I will order arbitration and I will select the arbitrator and I will do so in the next couple of days unless the parties can agree on an arbitrator. And that was the process. The parties did agree and both parties had placed the two individuals on the same list. Number one choice of the union was not available. The number one choice of the university was, and that's who arbitrated. The arbitration decision in 74, the union disagreed with a considerable portion of it. And I believe the university did as well. And that is obviously the risk you take with arbitration.
I thought in 74 you did not go to arbitration.
In 74 we did go to arbitration. It was a strike and it ended in binding arbitration. In 76 there was a strike, but the parties did not go to arbitration. The other thing that I maybe just comment on in terms of the statute and where I think it is accurate also is that there is a limit to our right to strike. And that limit is basically set by the court on two criteria. One, a pattern of good faith bargaining by the parties, and two, when it has a damaging impact on the community. Okay. In 1974, that particular strike, I believe, went about 7 days, and the university sought to have the strike enjoined. And during that period of time, there was considerable bad faith bargaining on the part of the university, and the Superior Court judge, in his closing comment, refused to enjoin the strike. He said that the university's bargaining reeked with bad faith, and I will not enjoin the strike. And so while we prevailed in terms of the not being enjoined, it did extend the duration of that strike. That particular strike lasted 17 days and was enjoined at that time, and that's when I went to binding arbitration. The second strike lasted a period of 7 days, the 76 strike. And so I think the courts somewhat have looked at the pattern of negotiations, the good faith of the parties, and they have set some guidelines and criteria that will be utilized in determining what the length should be. Strikes are not something that teachers like particularly. teachers are the ones who have their pay cut and are frequently terminated, and those pressures put on the faculty. Administrators continue to do whatever they do and get paid for it. And so I think there is much more pressure on the teachers' union to make a decision to strike. And I would, in closing, just ask that you get an opportunity to review some of this backup document. There are enclosed there statements in opposition to the resolutions from the Anchorage, Fairbanks, Sitka, and Ketchikan Central Labor Councils, from the Western Alaskan Building Trades, and from the American Federation of Teachers. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions that you might have regarding this.
Thank you. Other questions, Mr. McGrath?
Ralph, Mr. Chairman, Ralph, what's happened between 74 and 2 years ago? I mean, 76. Have there been negotiated agreements without problem, or what's transpired?
Yeah. I would argue that July 79 was, June 79 was really a turning point, and that certainly represents the date that President Barton assumed the office of the presidency of the University of Alaska. The events of the, we were in negotiations in the spring of 1979 for a successor agreement, and the parties did reach a agreement at the bargaining table. It was the first contract that had been negotiated without strike, without mediation, without binding arbitration, without any of those processes having been used. At the June meeting of the Board of Regents, that President Barton and the regents decided that they would study it for another month, although our membership had approved it by 96%. What happened was that in July, when the regents met the second time, President Barton recommended that the regents reject that contract, and it was rejected. What followed from there was 7 months of rather intense and strong animosity. The State Labor Relations Agency found the university to have committed some unfair labor practices during that period of time. The teachers, we had, when we negotiated the contract in the spring of that year, because we missed the legislative session, Governor Hammond had agreed that the funding of that contract would be put on a special session in August of that year. And the day that the governor announced that there was going to be funded a community college contract at blank dollars was the same day the Board of Regents rejected the contract. And so 7 months was rather difficult times. The following year, parties negotiated simply a salary increase. Nothing else was reopened in the contract. 6.28% salary increase. And that was the last of the negotiations until we entered into negotiations this January of 1983.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Walker.
I did want to mention, Senator Moss is not here, that we do apologize for at least a letter that was sent from one of our faculty, which inadvertently identified Senator Moss as the sponsor of this particular legislation.
Well, you know, that is, if it's Mr. Thompson, he identified me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I called, and I tried to call Mr. Thompson. I was furious. That's a long story, and I'll tell you about my efforts to find Mr. Thompson.
He also accused me, so.
Well, somebody programmed a computer.
Yes, I think it was
a computer-generated letter generated the same sponsor of the bill as the addressee of the letter.
Well, I apologize for that, and I can assure you that we know quite well that Senator Sacken introduced it at the request of the university, and that was at least any information we sent out for our membership. I apologize for that. Well, I do know talking to
Was it a computer error? He said it was another power play by Fisher and Joe Jones.
Didn't
I didn't know that we had power plays.
I do, maybe lastly.
And he lives in my district. That was the other part.
Bill Germain, who is the attorney for the ACCFT, as well as other labor unions, and for 10 years has covered the collective bargaining process with the university, does have a letter, and he asked that I deliver it today. I would like to provide that to the committee. Senator Halperin has another question. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I just got one question. I'm going through all these unfair labor practices, they all seem to represent amazingly superficial issues.
Amazingly.
Superficial. They don't, you know, it's who meets where and what the reasons are for meeting on these. I mean, I guess you don't ever get down to the question of how to negotiate a contract. It's all the parts and pieces before you ever get there. Is that the university's applications? Is that the union side? I mean, where are we going to Labor Relations Board on whether we meet on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, or Tuesdays and Thursdays, or whether we have a Xerox machine and a typewriter there, or whether we have it in the university building or in the laborer's hall?
The university took the position that they would meet at no other site during these negotiations than in the ACE Anchorage Community College Chancellor's Conference Room. And the contract simply provides that the parties shall meet in Anchorage. And when we proposed during those to try to resolve that, we proposed God, Country, and Union. St. Mary's Episcopal Church, Alaska Pacific University, Teamsters, Labor Hall, AFL, IBEW, none of those were acceptable. The only place they would meet with us was in the Chancellor's Conference Room. They said they had to be there because it was close to typewriters and telecommunications, and they had to have that since they had other more important duties, I guess, to be performed. And so he did take that position that that was the only.
Before you finish, he interrupts. My only question is not, you know, is that worth going to the Labor Relations Board over?
We took the position it was an unfair labor practice. We filed the unfair labor practice, and we continued to meet in the university's Chancellor's Conference Room under protest.
Dr. Barton, do you have something to add?
I would point out, I do think it's inappropriate to rehash arguments from age to age at this point.
Well, I think it was in response to a question. I must say, and I don't, and I hate to say this while Mr. McGrath is at the table, but I would apply it equally to Dr. Barton. I think that, at least as one public representative, the public interest here is to see that both sides settle their dispute, and so we move along with the educational program. I also want to say, Senator Sackett's representative is here, but I'm going to say something anyway, that the Finance Committee of the Senate, as Dr. Barton knows, is very concerned about productivity issues at the university. And in my judgment, the community college faculty in Anchorage is one of the most highly productive segments of the university, and that can be demonstrated by statistics. But it wouldn't be fair of me probably to let this hearing go by without acknowledging that the regents are under pressure from the legislature to see higher productivity in the university. For whatever that's worth, as you go back to the bargaining table, I think we fully understand that.
Thank you, brother. Sylvia Orr.
My name is Sylvia Orr, and I'm a negotiator for the ACCFT. I've been with Anchorage Community College since 1975. I'm a teacher that lives in the admission program, and this is the first time I've ever been involved in contract negotiations. And I'm addressing you today because of my deep concern over Senate Bill 467, which was introduced by Senator Sackett at the request of the university. As we've talked about today, that members or the teachers of the University of Alaska are currently members of Class 2A and APIRA. This allows us to go to this, to have a strike after mediation if necessary. Strike may be enjoined if it does threaten the health, safety, or welfare of the public. And if an impasse or deadlock still exists after the entrance of the injunction, then the parties do submit to arbitration. If Senate Bill 467 is passed, it would take away the right of us to go to binding arbitration. I have been a member of our negotiating team since negotiations did start last January, which is over 14 months ago. During this time, there have been numerous unfair labor practices filed, as has already been brought up today. And the university has been found guilty of many things. As we pointed out, many of these items are superficial items. I'd also like to point out that Dr. Barton, I believe that when we were the unfair labor practice referring to compensation, the merit system, and the workload, which I believe ULPC 83-1 mentioned today, so we did not know about unfair labor practice of those three items. We have attempted to settle our differences with a mediator since last April, and these attempts have failed. Because of the bargaining history, the ACCFT did ask the Alaska Labor Relations Agency to the right to a strike vote. There was an oral decision that was read on March 5th. And during this time, the agency concluded that the ACCFT does indeed have the right to a secret ballot strike vote. They found the same disagreements existed. It was the last May, May 83, but the university chose not to negotiate with the union, and that an impasse does exist. And they also strongly questioned the fact why, at this hearing, the university stated that they had just begun to bargain in January, which was 2 months ago, and negotiations have been going on for well over a year. We are conducting a strike vote that is being done under the auspices of the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. During this time, we are going to continue to mediate with a mediator that's appointed from the Alaska Department of Labor. And the State Labor Relations Agency will be appointing a mediator. I believe that the introduction of Senate Bill 467 can be seen as a ploy by the university to circumvent the collective bargaining process. As seen from the negotiations history, the university is not comfortable with unionization, nor do they want an arbitrated contract. This was made very strongly to us at the Board of Regents meeting that was in Anchorage about 3 weeks ago. I believe that if Senate Bill 467 is passed, it will give a very bleak outlook to the University of Alaska teachers.
Another question?
Yeah, I don't know what's proper to ask, but because I can't figure out what the real issues are, I'm going to ask them anyway. Aside from where the meetings are and who goes and who sets the time, what are the issues that people are arguing about? Like, are they pay? Are they working out? Are they class assignments? What are the core issues that are the reason for the impasse?
In January, there were two mediators that came up from Seattle, from the NLCF. And during this time, they narrowed their 25 outstanding issues and they narrowed them down to about four main points, which are workload, compensation, union rights, which the university refers to as subsidy, and management rights. So those are the four main issues.
Okay. Workload, compensation.
Union rights and management rights.
Okay, what are the things at issue? Union rights, management rights. What's that?
They include things like office space and leave time for your union personnel. And the management regards providing an office and a lighter workload for the union representative to be a quote subsidy plus quote again.
What are the management rights?
The management rights includes things such as not being able to add things to the contract without first talking to the union, not being able to change things in the contract.
And what are the workload issues?
The university wants total flexibility in assigning a workload assignment. And they would like to recognize a 30-credit workload, of which 27 of those credits can be assigned to teach classes. They would agree that 15 credits can only be assigned once per year, so faculty members could be teaching 15 credits one semester and 12 credits another semester.
Is that with the apportionment of your load as between community service and classroom work?
Is what they are saying is if a faculty does teach 15 credits, that we would not have any community work, any other committee work, any meeting with student advising or anything. They say that the person just has to teach the 15 credits and that's it. And as a faculty member, like, well, that's virtually impossible just to do that and not
interact with students.
Okay, that's the management position. What's the union position?
The union position, in our current contract, we are teaching 24 credits. We teach 12 credits a semester, plus we have a fifth part, which can be committee work, it can be community work, curriculum development, whatever. We would like to maintain this teaching assignment that we can.
So faculty member teaches a minimum of 12 credits per semester, full-time faculty member.
This is what's called in the field takeaways, really, by the, in other words, it is not the historic situation of a dispute based merely on the union trying to improve this, the lot of its members. This is also, from your point of view, retrogressive.
I believe that, I don't know if I should say this off the top of my head, but I think that it's on the items proposed by the university are takeaways.
What's the money?
The university would like to put us on their merit system of pay, on the university compensation system. They would like us to get the same grade, the same salary increase that all other university employees get. They have just implemented their merit system of pay last year. They're not really sufficiently evaluated to see how it's working for such an employee. We would like, at the current time, we are on delay in step increases where a bargaining unit member can get a step increase, or they do automatically get a step increase this July 1. They can get a lane increase and go to the next lane with additional experience from the university licensing system or with additional credits. The university would like to abolish the lane and steps that we currently have and have us get the same system of compensation or the same raises that they get.
Senator Fisher.
Chairman, I just want to say, as a former faculty member of the University of Alaska, that so far as I'm concerned, 12 credits is a hell of a big teaching load, and 15 is unreasonable.
Especially the class size.
Right, especially if any attention whatsoever is paid to students. And, if this were just a machine grinding out diplomas, would be one thing, but if you're trying to teach students, if you want to help a student with any kind of remedial or advanced work, you simply have to have time, and 15 hours, just 15 credits just doesn't permit that. The other comment I would also like to make as somebody who's been a part-time teacher is that the compensation system is ridiculous. I don't know what the compensation differential is now, but it used to be something like one-third or one-fourth of what a regular university teacher got for teaching a course. For instance, if you come in as a professional teacher, course in law, which you probably have, you get compensated at far less than any janitor would ever get compensated. It's an insult, really. Part-time teachers now teach, I'm sure, only because they believe in the fact that they can make a contribution, because they sure as hell won't do it for the money.
I have had that experience, but I have no conflict because I taught last semester 8 years, so I don't have a problem.
Okay, 12 semester hours is teaching four courses that meet three times a week for 1 hour.
If we start getting the labs or the clinicals, then there is more time to follow. The labs are 2-to-1, say 2 hours of lab time per 1 credit. Many of the clinical practicum that would help science students or other students is a greater foundation. So we get people outside, they just, you're correct, that people just teaching classes, not only labs, that would be 12 hours a week. Starting into labs is considerably more.
Mr. Chairman, if I may interrupt, again from experience, I always figured that for every hour of classroom teaching, it was usually at least 2 hours of preparation and then additional time working with students. So it isn't lecturers simply spend 12 hours a week and then they go home, and that's all that's good.
And what you're saying is 12 hours a week is 36 hours a week for back.
No, I say help. No, I say preparation. Then there's work with students, there's grading papers. I say this. It'd be a few teachers who work only 40 hours a week.
As it is now, if you look at that, we have 42 hours per week. So they're getting 2-to-1 ratio for class preparation, test preparation, and so forth. Try it in the class. No, we all have office hours, but at least 6 hours per week to help students that do
that. Thank you very much.
I also have just a sheet to summarize my comments.
We have one more witness who's signified a desire to be heard. And Senator Halper has to leave shortly. Mr. Manners, how much material do you have?
Just three.
All right.
spot matters in the Alaska. My testimony will be brief. We're in opposition to this legislation. I hadn't planned to make much of a statement until I heard the testimony of an earlier witness, and I have a need to correct, I think, some inaccuracies that have been put before the committee. One pertains to a statement that suggested arbitration has a chilling effect. We have, in testimony before this committee on other legislation in the last session, provided me with data that shows that, in fact, that is not the case, and that arbitration does enhance the potential for settlement. Another bit of information was that, it was in earlier testimony, that the arbiters tend to favor the union. The statistical fact, again, on information that we had by this committee on another bill, demonstrated that the arbitration awards were extremely close and consistent with the awards reached on a bilateral basis. Also, it was implied here that the strike is an economic weapon that brings balance to the process. I would respectfully suggest that in the public sector, that is really an imbalance, and that the economic effect of a strike is more severely felt by those who are striking, the employees, and the employer doesn't have the burden of an economic loss necessarily as a result of a strike in the public sector. And finally, there was an implication in the earlier testimony that there is necessarily a restraint and in order to arbitration. I believe if I understand the Public Employee Relations Act correctly, that the public and or the employer may seek a restraint, and they do have the burden of showing the court that there is irreparable harm to the public health, safety, and or welfare, and that there is not necessarily an automatic